I'm looking around to see how many young children there are here, because there's a risk that what I'm about to do next offends people. Not too many. I'd like to show you a television commercial from 2004.
Come on, Mary. Well done, Mary.
Breathe, Mary, breathe.
Look, yonder star. Come on, Mary.
Has Mr. Kipling ever directed a nativity play before?
No. He does make exceedingly good cakes.
It's a go!
Hope hasn't shocked you too much. I'd imagine none of us has actually been to a nativity play involving midwives and anaesthetists. The reason I'm showing it to you is that this morning we're going to look at an alternative nativity story. We're doing a mini-series on passages in the Bible outside the Gospels dealing with Jesus' birth, and you don't get much more alternative than this morning. When he preached last week, Ben said that some of the passages we're looking at might find their way into the traditional nine lessons and carol services traditional to Christmas. I guarantee that you won't hear this morning's passage at any of the Christmas services you attend next month. In many ways, it's the sister passage to what Ben preached on last week from Genesis 3, but this time, rather than being in the first book in the Bible, it's in the last book in the Bible, in the book of Revelation. So, Revelation chapter 12, Darren's going to come and read it to us.
A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on its heads. Its tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that it might devour her child the moment he was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the wilderness to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient snake called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah. For the accuser of our brothers and sisters, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They triumphed over him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury, because he knows that his time is short." When the dragon saw that he had been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman was given the 2 wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the wilderness, where she would be taken care of for a time, times and half a time, out of the snake's reach. Then from his mouth the snake spewed water like a river, to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus.
Thanks very much, Darren. I guess in the coming weeks you'll receive cards with that sort of image on it. According to this passage, a more appropriate picture might be something like this. But I don't suppose that Clinton Cards stocks too many cards like that for Christmas. The fact is that whilst much of the imagery around Christmas can feel at times rather like having 17 sugars in your tea, this morning's passage is rather like a full-on bitter Turkish coffee, something which is a shock to the system. It presents another truth around the nativity story, not a contradictory story to the usual nativity story, but a complementary one, one that sits alongside the shepherds and the innkeeper and the wise men and so on. It's another side of the same coin. It helps to explain what's going on. If all you experience at Christmas is away in a manger and silent night, then you miss out on part, at least, of what's going on. So let's try and explain this chapter, Revelation 12. Let's start with a who's who. So the woman giving birth is not Mary, as in the Gospel story, but symbolises the people of God. You get that from the sun, moon and stars reference in verse 1. Those of you who remember the story of Joseph in the Old Testament or are fans of the Technicolor Dreamcoat musical will remember one of Joseph's dreams involving the sun, moon and stars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. And the Bible commentators all agree that that's what's represented here. The woman is the people of God. The child, well, that's Jesus. You get that from the reference in verse 5 to ruling the nations with an iron scepter. And you'll see there's a footnote there that harks back to Psalm 12 and the description of Jesus there. The one character you don't need explaining as to who it is the dragon, because verse 9 explains it for us. That ancient serpent called the devil or Satan who leads the whole world astray. This is the same serpent that we encountered last week in Genesis 3, deceiving Adam and Eve into disobeying God. Well, so much for the characters. What does this passage have for us? What lessons can we take from it? Well, it shows us the past, it shows us the future, and it shows us the present. So let's look at the past first. After all, that's what Christmas sermons do. They look back to what happened 2,000 years ago. The woman, the people of Israel, remember, is in pain. Do you see that from verse 2? The Old Testament teaches that the cry of the people of God was for a Messiah, someone to rescue them from the situation they were in, both when faced with physical enemies and more profoundly, when faced with the consequences of their rebellion against God. We heard last week how Adam and Eve had disobeyed God and how, as a consequence, they were under a sentence of death. From that point, the story of the Old Testament, the first part of the Bible, is of God revealing his desire to commit to his people as their God, but the failure of the people of Israel to meet his standards. They take on the consequences of Adam and Eve's rebellion and face the same sentence of death that they did. The people are in pain, and in this passage, it's likened to labour pains. And a child is born. But there's a problem. A dragon, opposed to the child, is waiting to devour it. Now let's stop there. The standard Christmas story doesn't have any baddies apart from Herod. So why this talk about dragons wanting to eat children? It's all a bit fairy tale-ish, isn't it? A bit bogeyman telling stories about monsters to scare children into obedience. Well, doubtless lots of monster stories do have that as their purpose, but I think we're in different territory here. As Julian was explaining earlier, it's one of the central truths of the Christian faith that God is not the only supernatural being. There is an evil spiritual being as well as a good spiritual being. There is an evil force opposed to the good, whose purpose is undermining God and his purposes and attacking mankind. Now, if that appears hocus-pocus to you, then apologies. This is what we in the church believe, because this is what the Bible teaches. You may believe that all evil in the world is down to bad men and women, but the Bible tells us that that is not the complete answer. And here, in our alternative nativity story, the enemy is real, active, and predatory. So back to the passage. When it comes to the story of Jesus' life, you'll note it's a bit truncated, to say the least. Verse 5, he's born. Verse 5, he's snatched up to heaven. Where's his teaching? Where's his death? Where's his resurrection? We go straight from Bethlehem to the ascension. Then what comes next in Revelation 12 is the angels, but it's a world away from kids in year 2 at the school nativity dressed in white blankets and tinsel, saying peace on earth and goodwill to all men. Peace on earth maybe, but war in heaven. The devil is defeated and hurled down to earth. Down at earth, he pursues the people of God, but he's thwarted. So, according to this passage, that's what has happened. So much for the past. How about the future? Well, there's only a passing reference to it here in verse 12. Do you see there where it says that Satan is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short? What does it mean, do you think, where it says his time is short? Well, we're not told directly in this passage, so we have to look further ahead in the 20th chapter of Revelation. This is what verse 10 of chapter 20 says. The devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet have been thrown. They will be tormented day and night forever and ever. The Bible teaches that the certain outcome for God's enemy, Satan, is that he is under a sentence of death. That the time will come when he is destroyed forever and will no longer have any ability to interfere in human affairs. That's what the future holds, but I want to spend most of this morning, most of this sermon, talking about the present. What does this passage say to us about what life is like for the followers of Jesus today? Well, during the Christmas season, you'd be forgiven looking around thinking that all of God's people are going to be happy and contented, looking forward to a lovely family time and welcoming in the baby Jesus. I wonder if that's how everyone here is feeling today. If you are, fantastic. But I'm sure that for many inside this church and out, this coming Christmas season will be one of loneliness and worry, whether it's worrying about money, relationships, or other things. And the required jollity and fun at this time of year can be tiresome at best and hateful at worst. There's a sentimentality around at this time of year that refuses to acknowledge hardship and difficulty. It can be very hard to process if you're not in a good place. That's one of the reasons I was so keen to preach on this morning's passage. The Bible isn't sentimental when it talks about Jesus' birth in the Gospels, and sure as anything, it isn't sentimental here. What we have here is an insight into what's happening in the spiritual realm and an explanation as to why things don't always go to plan for God's people. In this passage, we see the present reality for the people of God and the way to deal with it. So first, the present reality. What are the consequences of Satan being unable to destroy Jesus and being defeated in heaven? Look with me, please, at verse 12. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them, but woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short. A bit different from joy to the world, isn't it? Verse 17, then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast their testimony about Jesus. In the Christmas story, the story that we're all familiar with, the angels announced a message of joy to the shepherds on the hill. But here it's not joy, but woe that is announced. What we see is that the people of God have a powerful enemy, and that enemy is both bent on harming them and is filled with fury. This is a key spiritual truth. We don't live our lives in a spiritual vacuum, but we're in a spiritual fight with a spiritual enemy. And it's clear that that enemy is very powerful. Look with me at verse 3 and the description of Satan there. He's described as having 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 crowns. Now, these are all signs of power and authority. Look at verse 4. Verse 4 says that he swept stars out of the sky with his tail. This is clearly a very powerful being and not one to be underestimated. It's also clear that he has particular functions to play. Look at verse 9. He's described as leading the world astray. And verse 10, he's described as being the accuser of our brothers and sisters. So we see how this powerful being operates. He operates to deceive. We saw that, didn't we, last week from the story of the Garden of Eden, which Ben preached on. Satan persuaded Eve that God's promises of death, if man disobeyed God's commands, were a lie. Adam and Eve disobeyed and found themselves under a sentence of death. And Satan also operates to accuse. He's the whisper in your ear that says, call yourself a Christian. You know that God can't forgive you for that thing you've done. You might as well give up. After all, you're never going to make the grade. Not only does Satan have these objectives in mind, but it's clear from verse 12, he's particularly focused on following them through because of his fury. His knowledge that he is doomed drives him on. There's a scene in the first Lord of the Rings film when Gandalf is battling a huge demon in the Dwarf Kingdom, and the demon falls into the abyss but reaches out with its whip and drags Gandalf down with it. It's the same picture here. Satan knows he is doomed, and that knowledge drives him on to take as many of God's people down with him as he can. Sometimes I think in the church we can get complacent in dealing with the devil because we know that he is defeated. And so he is. But he's still active. And the knowledge that he is defeated makes him more active in wanting to lash out. It says elsewhere in the New Testament, the devil is like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. He actively looks for opportunities to get after mankind, and in particular Jesus' followers. It says here that he wages war against them in verse 17. What does that mean, do you think? What does that look like? Well, I think it means that he deceives and accuses them. And more than anything, his desire in doing so is for people who profess to follow Jesus to follow their own ways or another way. At the beginning of his ministry, Jesus himself was tempted by the devil. And when Satan tempted Jesus, he did 3 things. He offered him bread when he was hungry. He offered him a way to glory without having to go through death, and he offered him a chance to prove his importance. Satan used the things that he knew were in the mind of Jesus, and that's his pattern. He uses those things that will work to attack the people of God, that he thinks will work, whether it's offering us things we desperately need or want, an answer to our loneliness, a way out of dangerous situations, advancement at work, or certainty when only uncertainty exists. If only we'd make a compromise here. If only we'd disobey God there. The devil also uses other tactics. He discourages the followers of Jesus in any way he can by putting difficulty and opposition in their way. In the book of Job in the Old Testament, Satan attacks Job with calamity and disease to discourage him and persuade him to turn aside from his faith. So how can we deal with these attacks? How can we overcome? The key is in verse 11. We follow the example of the angels. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Now, this is very practical. Satan was defeated by the blood of the Lamb, that is, the death of Jesus on the cross to pay the penalty for our rebellion against God. He was also defeated by the testimony of the angels, by their actions and words, bearing witness to Jesus' rescue. What does it mean for us to defeat Satan by our testimony? Well, it means that followers of Jesus, not just saying that they follow Jesus, but putting their money where their mouth is, in following Jesus in their actions, in following the pattern of the cross, in sacrificing and suffering in order to reach glory. I came across a particularly vivid example of following Jesus in deed as well as word in the story of a Maasai man called Joseph. This is his story. One day, Joseph, who was walking along one of these hot, dirty African roads, met someone who shared the gospel of Jesus Christ with him. Then and there, he accepted Jesus as his Lord and Saviour. The power of the Holy Spirit began transforming his life. He was filled with such excitement and joy that the first thing he wanted to do was return to his own village and share that same good news with the members of his local tribe. Joseph began going from door to door, telling everyone he met about the cross of Jesus and the salvation it offered, expecting to see their faces light up in the way his had. To his amazement, the villagers not only didn't care, they became violent. The men of the village seized him and held him to the ground while the women beat him with strands of barbed wire. He was dragged from the village and left to die alone in the bush. Joseph somehow managed to crawl to a waterhole and there, after days of passing in and out of consciousness, found the strength to get up. He wondered about the hostile reception he'd received from people he'd known all his life. He decided he must have left something out or told the story of Jesus incorrectly. After rehearsing the message he'd first heard, he decided to go back and share his faith once more. Joseph limped into the circle of huts and began to proclaim Jesus. He died for you so that you might find forgiveness and come to know the living God, he pleaded. Again, he was grabbed by the men of the village and held while the women beat him, reopening wounds that had just begun to heal. Once more, they dragged him unconscious from the village and left him to die. To have survived the first beating was truly remarkable. To live through the second was a miracle. Again, days later, Joseph awoke in the wilderness, bruised, scarred, and determined to go back. He returned to the small village, and this time they attacked him before he had a chance to open his mouth. As they flogged him for the third and probably the last time, he again spoke to them of Jesus Christ the Lord. Before he passed out, the last thing he saw was that the women who were beating him began to weep. This time, he awoke in his own bed. The ones who had so severely beaten him were now trying to save his life and nurse him back to health. The entire village had come to Christ. Now, of course, that's a fairly unusual and extreme example. But the point is this: Joseph faced suffering and discouragement in his attempt to live out his faith by sharing the good news of Jesus Christ. He persisted and overcame the opposition by his willingness to suffer and tell the truth about Jesus. As it says in this morning's passage, he overcame the devil by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of his testimony. He did not love his life so much as to shrink from death. But maybe the devil is more subtle with you. Maybe you won't face Kenyan villagers trying to kill you. Maybe you won't face physical threats against you at all, but just the prospect of having to pass up a chance for advancement at work, to pass up a relationship with someone you've taken a shine to. Remember that Jesus, in his temptation, wasn't faced with physical violence. Instead, he was offered things it would have been wrong for him to take. The devil likes to deceive. Or maybe the devil will whisper that you're not good enough, that you're a fraud sitting in this church with that thing that only you know about, with that dirty secret or those thoughts that you struggle to move from. How dare you, the devil says, think that you can come here and pretend that you're good enough. Maybe that resonates with you. How do we deal with these attacks? Well, by remembering the reason that we're here. We're not here because we're good. We're here because we know we're not good. We're not here to do anything to improve our situation. Our situation was improved once and for all on an execution site on a hill outside Jerusalem in around AD 30 and in the tomb 3 days later. This passage shows us why we're here, and in doing so shows us how to answer the doubts, the internal voice that accuses us. We're here because although we've gone our own way and followed our own selfishness that takes us from God, Jesus came down as a perfect man to take our place in suffering the punishment for our rebellion, which was death and separation from God. So that if you follow Jesus, when God sees you, he does not see your imperfection and rebellion. He sees Jesus' perfection and obedience. That's the answer that beats the devil. We can say, you cannot accuse me of anything, because God is faithful and just to forgive my wrongs and make me clean and perfect before him. He does so because I trust in what Jesus achieved for me on the cross, and I base my life around his death and his resurrection. Against that, and against the decision of Christians to let their lives reflect the truth of the gospel, the devil has no answer. So this Christmas, listen to the stories of the shepherds and the angels. It's a joyful time. God has come to us. He has visited us and proclaimed that there is a way for us to have peace with him. And bear a thought when you hear the Christmas stories of the other important aspects of Jesus' life. Think on the gift of myrrh from the wise men, and how that gift, which was used for preparing the body for burial, points to the deeper truth of Christmas, that Jesus came so that we might defeat Satan just as he did. Jesus came to die so that we might live.